From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it's time for our Friday Reporter Roundtable today. And our panel today includes Carly Flandro, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News. Hi, everybody.
Happy Friday.
So, a lot going on this week, in particular, some stuff at the U.S. Supreme Court. So, Jimmy, I want to start there. A decision came down from the U.S. Supreme Court this week, and it has huge impacts on transgender youth in Idaho. So can you tell us about this?
It does. So this majority opinion from Justice Neil Gorsuch, first of all, we should say this is not like a final decision. This is just, hey, this lower court decision that was blocking this law that allowed, or at least the law was banning the use of gender-affirming care for minors in Idaho, that can now take effect. It was supposed to take effect in January, but a lower court decision blocked it. So for, you know, roughly 4 months, that has now been blocked. But this opinion from Gorsuch essentially lifts that except for those who filed suit to challenge the law. So that means that anyone under 18, if they are trying to get puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or gender confirmation surgery, which we've been told by medical providers isn't being offered in Idaho, if they're trying to get those for gender transition purposes, that is not okay. That is not allowed to happen anymore. You can still get those medications for other conditions, but you know, if you're transitioning, no dice.
So, Jimmy, does that mean that with this decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that this that this law is now automatically back into effect?
It is back into effect. However, the ongoing case underpinning this that's being challenged is still going on. It's still at the district court level, which is the first sort of federal rung of the judiciary ladder. So, you know, this case could potentially go on for several more months, maybe even years at that level alone, not to mention any sort of appeals that might make their way through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court itself.
Okay. Okay. So I want to make sure I understand this, because can youth who then are, you know, suffering from you know, body dysmorphia, they are transgender, they are getting this care, right? Even though the U.S. Supreme Court came down with this decision this week and the law goes into effect, because there are these other lawsuits going on, is this care still able to happen, or is it not, or can they not get any of this type of care?
They should not be able to get any of this care aside from the handful of people who are suing to block this law, you know, overall, which is why it was such a big deal. And that's actually something that was pointed out by Justice Gorsuch in his opinion, saying that essentially the lower rungs of the federal court system have run amok by, you know, assigning these broad, universal injunctions that apply to each and every person, as opposed to just those who are trying to get some relief from the court system, which is why they are still allowed to access this care if they're still under 18.
Okay, so as these other cases are in the lower courts, Jimmy, these other cases could then potentially end up at the U.S. Supreme Court, and if they were to make a different decision at the U.S. Supreme Court, we could potentially see this law being overturned or not. And maybe I'm getting too much in the weeds to this, but I'm trying to understand this.
Yeah, no, it's a very complicated situation because there are a lot of different appeals courts around around the country, and they are making their own decisions. This is just in effect until there is some kind of final decision. Again, even if, you know, this gets appealed to the Ninth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit sides with whomever, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take up the case at all. You know, there could be a final decision made at these lower appellate courts too.
Okay. So even though we've seen this law put back into place and it is now law here in the state of Idaho, I would surmise to say that we have not heard the end of where this is.
No, it's just going to take a long time. And in that time, you know, people, you know, who are transgender and under 18 are going to have to look elsewhere for this kind of treatment.
Okay. I appreciate that update, Jimmy, and all of those questions I had for you. So thank you. Melissa, some really sad news out of the legislature this week as we found out about the passing of Sue Chu. For folks who may not be familiar with her, can you tell us a little bit about her? Because really a trailblazer within the legislature in so many regards.
Representative Sue Chu served the Boise bench area in the Idaho House for 18 years. It made her the longest serving Idaho Democrat. And in the House of Representatives overall, the second longest serving current representative. She was a pharmacist by trade and was very active on the House Health and Welfare Committee. She worked across the aisle on a lot of bills regarding the pharmacy industry and in general. And she didn't debate a lot in committee or on the floor unless she really felt strongly about issues. She was more known for her grassroots work. She did a lot of work in the community, reaching out to marginalized populations, doing door-to-door work with her constituents. I live in her district and, mm-hmm. you know, I'd be riding my bike around and I would run into her knocking on doors and checking in on constituents. And this would be outside of election years. She wasn't campaigning. She was just checking in during one debate or during a resolution that the House passed in March to honor her and her commitment to Idaho. Her seatmate, Representative John Gannon, said that when he was first campaigning and running for the legislature, he knocked on somebody's door and went in and talked to them about issues. And she pointed out, well, when Sue Chu was here, she did my dishes. I mean, she cared up. Seriously, she cared about her constituents and her community so much. And she had a lot of respect from her colleagues. And, you know, I first met her in 2005, but really got to know her since I started covering the legislature in 2011. And mm-hmm. I know a lot of people are going to miss her. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer late last year and sat out the 2024 session while she was getting treatment for it. And I know a lot of people in the community are really mourning her loss.
Mm-hmm. And Jimmy, I know you didn't know her well, but you had some dealings with her. Tell us about that.
Not too many, actually. I mean, like Melissa mm-hmm. said, she was pretty quiet in committee or on the House floor. Didn't really speak much. I also live in her district and saw her walking around a decent amount. Heard some stories from some people this week talking about how, you know, she would randomly call people to even try to get help for a constituent who is trying to get like a stove out of a second floor apartment. Just like, hey, like come help. What are you doing right now? You need a break?
Right, exactly.
let's go yeah. lift this thing out of this apartment. So I mean, it just kind of underscores that there was an outpouring of support from you know, on Facebook and Twitter and other social media sites as well, just talking about how much they were going to miss her. And she was pretty young too. I mean, she was 66 when she died.
Yeah,
I've really got to say, half the time when I ran into her, more than half the time, she had a student with her. She cared deeply about education too, mm-hmm. and training up the next generation of civil servants. You know, she was always introducing me to an intern or a student who was shadowing her, and she always knew something about them, and she always was excited to talk about them. I mean, she mm-hmm. genuinely cared about the people that she worked with and that she served.
And Melissa, I think you said this, right? That when she was diagnosed, she did say that she would not run for re-election. But so what then does happen with her seat now? I'm assuming it's an election.
Right. I, you know, the She had already announced her retirement by the time she had been diagnosed. But because there is still the remainder of her legislative term, the governor will ultimately appoint a replacement for that seat based on a list that is submitted to his office from that District 17 Central Committee. And so, you know, in case of a special session or any sort of outside of the regular legislative session committee work that lawmakers would normally do, that's where that substitute or th that's where that newly appointed lawmaker would step in. Already, she had substitutes sitting in for her for the entirety of the 2024 legislative session.
Okay, thanks for that update. She will definitely be missed. Carly, let me bring you into the conversation. And let's head over to Eastern Idaho, the Idaho Falls School District, to be exact. I think it's fair to say maybe staff there is just reeling today, Carly. Can you tell us about these pretty significant cuts that the school board just decided to make? And why? Because we're talking what, upwards of $4 million in cuts?
Yeah, so trustees unanimously decided last week to make $4.3 million in cuts, the bulk of that in personnel. So they did that because they've been overspending by about $4 million each year. And the superintendent, Carla LaOrange, she's new as the district superintendent this year. So she's gone back through the records, identified that it's due to a number of factors. A new program that allows parents to track the location of their students who ride buses, which was a one-time $1 million cost. Losing funding when it became based on attendance instead of enrollment, that switch was made. And so student or districts lost money because of that. Hiring more staff than the state funds and some COVID-19 dollars that are set to expire soon. She declined to give a more specific breakdown of where the dollars were overspent, and teachers and staff have been pushing for more transparency and more of a in-depth look into that. But going back to the cuts here, oh, and I should add that trustee said at the meeting they wanted to make the cuts to build their savings account back up so they can cover their operational expenses in between state and federal reimbursements and funding, which can be sporadic. So that's why the cuts were made. And here's what some of the cuts entail. Most of it is from personnel. So trustees voted to eliminate more than 20 staff positions, including some assistant principals and support staff like bookkeepers and college and career advisors. So Idaho Falls staff have been finding out last week in this that they won't have a job to return to in the fall, and they're scrambling to find something else. There's also been non-personnel cuts, like a $500,000 line item for student supplies like paper, pencil, markers, etc.
Okay, and then Carly, they've also made schedule changes due to the cutbacks, correct?
That's right. At the same meeting where they decided to make these cuts, they decided to switch up the schedule for next school year. So for secondary students, that's going to mean that they learn online one day a week. Unless they're falling behind, or maybe they're in an advanced or college class, and then they could be required to come in for a shortened day and extra help or instruction. At the elementary level, it's switching students from a 1 hour late start one day a week to a 1 hour early release one day a week. So staff have had mixed reactions to the change, but when paired with the cuts, some have criticized trustees for making too many changes all at once.
So I'm curious too about this, in particular with secondary students. I have a secondary education student. The last thing I want is for him to be home one day a week learning online, because I've seen how that works. With that said, I am curious, have parents said anything about this schedule change? Because in the piece that you wrote, Carly, I mean, I know staff are concerned about this, even though trustees say it'll boost graduation rates. And I'm sitting here just as a parent, not as a journalist, being like, how is that going to boost graduation rates when my kid's not in school one day a week?
Well, there are other school districts that do something similar to this. One of them is the Bonneville School District, which is also in the Idaho Falls area. So this schedule is called an intervention schedule. So intervention means that you identify a student who's struggling, and early on, you put in place supports and extra help to catch them up before it gets to be too far down the road. So that's the whole point of this one day a week, is that struggling students can come to school and they can go to the classes where they're specifically struggling. They can get one-on-one help from their teacher, and they can have like this big study hall, basically. And so the idea behind it is that it'll target that struggling population the most and help them to graduate. And the trustees were saying like that evidence shows that this helps them. I haven't looked into those claims or what the evidence is exactly, but that's what the thinking and the rationale is. It also provides teachers more time to collaborate and plan, which some argue trickles down to the students and helps them as well.
No, fair enough. I appreciate that explanation. So, Jimmy, you looked at campaign finance records recently, as well as a lot of rematches for certain legislative seats, as we are in an election year. Can you just start with campaign finance records? And I believe you looked at the month of March.
I did, yeah. So that just came out recently. It's starting to become interesting because a lot of the money that gets spent is usually within the last month. And we're not going to really know that for a little bit. But since December 2022, legislative candidates have raised more than $2.4 million, according to the Secretary of State's office. Keep in mind, these are legislative candidates. These are not statewide candidates. Think like the attorney general or the governor. They have, these districts with, a few tens of thousands of people in them. They've also spent about $1.5 million in that time. And specifically, the most expensive race that we're seeing so far is the rematch between current Republican Senator Scott Herndon and Jim Woodward, who Herndon unseated in 2022. That district is the, tip top of the panhandle, district number one. And combined, they've raised, about $190,000, which to me is kind of mind-blowing for a legislative race. Woodward's a few thousand dollars ahead of Herndon in that regard, and we'll kind of get a better idea of, that sort of fundraising race here in a few weeks, to see who ultimately comes out on top there. But there are also several other rematches. I think I counted at least eight. You've got especially one closer in the Treasure Valley here with Senate District Number 13 with current Senator Brian Lenny facing off against former Senator Jeff Agenbrod, both Republicans. Again, Lenny unseated Agenbrod, and those two have raised, roughly a combined 70-ish thousand dollars. So again, not quite as much as $190,000, but still serious cash for a legislative race that you have to, stand for election every 2 years.
And so we will see how some of these races, I'm assuming, could go in May with the primary, Jimmy, if we've got like, two Republicans up against each other.
I mean, that's exactly right. The other thing to keep in mind is, it's not just about the money that the candidates themselves raise. I don't know necessarily from years past, but in my head, these independent expenditures, things like PAC money or expenses from different central campaign committees, think county parties and things like that. Those are hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, individually for things like radio and TV ads, mailers that you get sent directly to your home, internet ads, Facebook, things like that, that are super expensive. Those haven't really started yet. Again, those are mostly spent within the last month of a race historically that we've seen, and especially like that last 2 weeks when early voting is open, people are filling out their absentee ballots and really finally thinking about, oh, who am I going to choose when I go to the polls next week?
Yeah, absolutely. Melissa, we talked about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision regarding transgender care in the last segment. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments next week in another case involving Idaho. This one is in regards to EMTALA. And I should note, we're going to be doing quite a big preview on Monday in our program. I know you've done that as well, Melissa, on your program. But maybe for folks who are not familiar, explain to us what EMTALA is and why this is now going in front of the U.S. Supreme Court.
EMTALA is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. It's a federal law that applies to emergency rooms and hospitals that accept Medicaid. And what it does is mandate that those facilities must provide stabilizing treatment to patients in emergencies. The United States Justice Department and several people who have signed on to this lawsuit, mostly physicians groups, have argued that those treatments can sometimes include abortions. And that's where they argue the federal law conflicts with Idaho's ban on abortions. Attorney General Raul Labrador, who is representing the state of Idaho, argues that the state's abortion ban does not conflict with EMTALA because it allows physicians to perform abortions when the patient's life is in jeopardy. So basically to save the life of the mother. But the conflict here is, according to physicians, the conflict is not all stabilizing treatments are to prevent death. Some of them are to preserve the patient's health. So to say, prevent hysterectomy or kidney issues or other problematic health conditions that wouldn't necessarily kill a patient, but would absolutely adversely affect their health. Mm-hmm. So there previously, there was a stay on this law, but in January, the court lifted that stay. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted that stay. So that allowed Idaho to fully enforce it. And there was a press call yesterday that Kelsey Mosley Morris of State's Newsroom covered that said St. Luke's is already seeing the effects of that stay. Since January, St. Luke's has had to airlift patients with pregnancy complications to other states six times because of that confusion or uncertainty over EMTALA and how it applies to Idaho's abortion law. That's compared to just one time last year. And so we have on our show this week, constitutional law professor McKay Cunningham with the College of Idaho, discussing what he anticipates those oral arguments are going to focus on based on the briefs that have already been filed and constitutional questions concerning this this case. And, you know, ultimately, whether medical opinions matter when we're talking about things like the Supremacy Clause, you know, it at the end of the day, does it matter if the doctors say this could result in adverse effects for patients when if Idaho, the court feels, has the constitutional right to do this? And so those are things that we're all going to be watching for. Oral arguments are on Wednesday, and we're certainly going to be covering those.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, we'll actually have McKay Cunningham on our show on Monday. We will also be talking with an attorney from St. Luke's. They have filed an amicus brief, and so we will also be sitting down with them to discuss this further. Carly, let me bring you back into the conversation again. So what's going on in regards to violations when it comes to special education? But these are laws that are potentially being broken around this?
Yeah, so there's a federal law. It's called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And it basically ensures a free and appropriate public education for all students. So under that, there's certain things that schools are required to do. And I made a public records request with the State Department of Education for investigations into alleged violations of that law. And I found that in 2023, dozens of people filed those complaints. There were 37 grievances filed in all, and 35 of those were found to have violations of federal law, and that spanned 25 districts and charters across the state. So it was more than 400 pages of documents altogether, and they showed how some schools have foundered their federal responsibility under that act to appropriately educate their students. And a common trend I found was that there was a frequent disregard for parents' concerns, requests, and opinions. And these parents have repeatedly reported feeling unheard or misled in discussions with school leaders about their children's needs. And in some cases, districts didn't take any actions to remedy issues that they brought forward until the state investigated. So in these cases, once the state investigates, they send out their final report of their findings, and then usually the district is required to do things to fix it. So that might entail like a staff-wide training on special education law, holding mediated meetings with parents, or making up for services that were not provided to a student originally that should have been. And in some cases, these reports identified systemic issues. So one of those was with Oneida School District, which has an online school underneath its umbrella. And that's where a lot of the issues stemmed from. And in that case, the issues were so entrenched that state oversight will be necessary for years to come. There were 15 violations with Oneida School District. So it was definitely a standout. And then this year in 2024, investigators have reported in the first 3 months, January, February, and March, that five school districts were out of compliance. And one of the standouts there was systemic issues at Garden Valley School District. So the issues identified there ranged from an extended resource room, and that's where students with your biggest needs will be found, that was seemingly run by paraprofessionals rather than a certified special education teacher, to special education evaluations and plans that were rushed, incomplete, or even harmful rather than helpful. So there's a lot there, but that's a basic summary.
Yeah. Logan, thank you for being so patient, waiting for us to get to you. We started the program today talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding Idaho's transgender ban. And I know, Logan, you recently talked with a Boise doctor on your podcast about this. And I understand we have a clip from that interview. So can you set this up for us and who the doctor is?
Absolutely, Gemma. Yeah, this is a clip from my interview with Dr. Marvin Alviso. He's a family medicine physician here in Boise. And I want to thank him. We literally just did this interview last night after a long workday for him and I both. So this is going to come out on our podcast for next week. But in this clip, he's talking about how he found out this week that the Supreme Court allowed this law to take effect. So let's take a listen to that.
I actually had a patient who I am ready to counsel with cross-sex hormones. He's been on puberty blocker for a year. And then I kind of told him like what the effects of testosterone, and then I was pulled from the room by my nurse and said, you've got to see this, and this is bad. I have to tell that to the parent and to the patient. And it was just devastating to see like his eyes, like just like really teary. And then the dad was just like really not nodding their head, was just like, can't do anything about this. And I'm sure they were just really composed about that visit. But so you can imagine like your lifeline being cut off like immediately. It also poses like a legal and ethical dilemma for me. Like, do we follow? Of course, like I don't want to be imprisoned for this. I mean, I would want to do what's best for a patient, which is science-backed, and this is what's supposed to be. And then we have these legal things that I cannot do because of politics meddling with medicine.
So Logan, what a powerful soundbite right there. What else did the doctor have to say when you were interviewing him?
Well, it was honestly a very educational and informative interview for me. We talk mm-hmm. in pretty good detail about what medical intervention looks like when it comes to transition, because when it comes to transgender people, there's a lot of complex elements of transitioning. There's the social aspects where you're changing the way that you dress, changing the pronouns that you ask people to use when they're referring to you. And that's the type of stuff you don't need to go see a doctor for. So I was very curious, like when specifically when a transgender minor is coming into the doctor's office and saying, hey, mm-hmm. I think we need some sort of medical treatment here. I was very happy to actually get some details about what that looks like, all of the steps that they have to go through, the counseling, the testing. It very much confirmed for me that this is not something that doctors are just doing willy-nilly.
So explain that a little bit more, if you would, Logan, about what you learned in that process, in particular to that when they go see a doctor, right? When they decide that maybe they want to be on something like a puberty blocker, because I would imagine and I think your podcast will educate so many of us, is that they're not just handed that. You mentioned things like therapy, right? I would assume that is part of this whole process.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is often a situation where so this doctor who I spoke with specifically performs gender affirming care and provides that for Idaho families and patients. Oftentimes that comes by way of referral from a counselor or from a psychiatrist, or the family history. The family has records and is able to speak to the child's experience. So depending on the age of the child, if they have not started puberty yet, if they're still at that young age, there's really nothing to do other than the kind of those social aspects and affirming the child's identity. But he really spoke with me about the fact that it's not just the primary sexual characteristics. So your chest and your genitalia are what we commonly think of, but for students and teenagers, especially, you know, all of your peers are developing at the same time. Your hips are getting broader or your shoulders are getting broader. You're getting taller. For boys, our voices get deeper. And there's a lot of those secondary characteristics that can actually have a really big mental health impact on these young people as well. And when I spoke with the doctor, he also said they're very deliberate in the screening and in the panels and things that they do beforehand, that they're making sure they're also looking at neurological conditions like ADHD, depression, anxiety, stuff like that, to make sure it's not something else that could be misinterpreted as a gender identity related issue. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So highly complex. Logan, I have less than a minute before I need to go to break. When and where can people hear this podcast?
Yeah, go ahead and search Idaho Reports wherever you listen to podcasts. Go ahead and subscribe to us there. And that interview is coming out on Wednesday, April 24th.
Okay. Well, as always, I want to thank everyone again. A thank you to our very own James Dawson and Melissa Devlin. Both of them had to leave earlier. But thank you to Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, who stayed with us for the remainder of that time. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.